This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, almost 7 years after Katrina, New Orleans school employees win some payback in court. Human rights lawyer Lynn Stewart loses her appeal of a long prison sentence. And a racist town in Texas refuses to change its ways.
But first, the Obama administration is ecstatic about the U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding the president's health care legislation. However, progressives in the health care field are not pleased. Margaret Flowers was among a group of doctors who filed a brief with the court on behalf of single-payer Medicare for All. She expects the administration to claim that the people have won some kind of victory when the real winners are the corporations.
Absolutely, that's what they're going to be saying. I mean, this whole discussion in the corporate media has been about politics instead of about healthcare, which is what, we should actually be talking about in this country. What this does now, forcing people to purchase private insurance, which is a faulty product, meaning that people will spend up to 9% of their income and then still, because of copays and deductibles, not be able to afford to get actual healthcare, but still face bankruptcy, losing their homes. If they get a serious accident or illness, people in this country will still be making a choice between health care or sending their children to college. It keeps private insurance industry further entrenches them, further takes us in the direction of privatizing our health care. We're going to continue to lose doctors. Health care costs are going to continue to rise, and we're going to have a slow descent of suffering.
What many people said when President Obama's health care policies were being debated was that this would have the effect of saving the for-profit insurance industry, saving the profits of the drug corporations.
Absolutely. This law, this health law, was written by and for the corporations. It's the corporate welfare on steroids. We're giving $447 billion in taxpayer dollars directly to the private insurance companies. They're going to hang on to as much of that as they can. People are still not going to be able to afford health care. In Massachusetts, a recent poll found that 78% of those who have illnesses say they have serious problems paying for their health care. 63% say that they're worse off now than they were 5 years ago. This is what we're going to see at a national level now. But instead of realizing that we're still leaving people out, that we're not controlling health care costs, you're going to see celebration. People are being propagandized into believing this was the best that we could get, not realizing that this was the plan all along, and it wasn't for the people, it was for the corporations. The majority of us, people and physicians, want a Medicare for all. But until we stop being blinded by this rhetoric, this partisan rhetoric, until we get out in the streets and demand Medicare for all, we're not going to have it, and people are still going to suffer and die. That's not acceptable.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers in Washington.
National Nurses United, the biggest nurses union, also supports Medicare for All. Co-President Gene Ross says the fight isn't over.
We have always said, and we maintain and are continuing to move forward with a push for Medicare for All. What we see in our patients and their family members is people not coming in for care when they need it. People skipping medications because they can't afford them. If it's a choice between food and rent and medication, what are you going to pick? So while we look at the decision that most others are applauding that came out of the Supreme Court, it's kind of bittersweet for us because we know the healthcare system or the lack of it that we have in this country isn't going to get better with this. I am very happy for the extra people that will get some relief. For example, those people that are 26 and under that can stay on their parents' plan, that's wonderful, but nobody's addressing what if those poor parents couldn't afford it in the first place. So the people that will be helped, I'm very, very happy for them. But as nurses, we want a society that's healthy, all of us. No one should have to wait till they're 65 to have the best health care system, and that would be Medicare. That's what we need, Medicare for all from the time you're born.
Many critics of President Obama's plan say that it simply locks in escalating costs, the escalating costs of insurance, the escalating costs of drugs.
And that's what we said as National Nurses United from the get-go. It isn't that we are opposed to some sort of a compromise and trying to find a way that everyone can agree on. But when it does, like you say, lock in, or what I say, cement in a process that's just bad for us to start with, it doesn't get all our people covered. It is a for-profit system, which, if you believe that healthcare is a human right, doesn't make sense to do something for profit. It's going to cost us more in the long run. Even with the Affordable Care Act, yes, there are places for no pre-existing conditions. You can't be denied because of it. That makes sense. But there's really no safeguard for how much they can charge extra because you have a pre-existing condition. Those problems are still with us, and they will be until we get off of that kind of a system, which we believe we can do. And we happen to believe it's more important to do what's best for society than it is to get a solution everybody can agree on right away. So I would agree with anyone who says, no, this just cements a bad system in place.
Jean Ross, a co-president of National Nurses United.
The United States took a step towards joining the civilized world in its treatment of children with a decision by the highest court in the land. Brian Stevens, executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, explains.
The United States Supreme Court banned mandatory life imprisonment without parole sentences for children who have been convicted and sentenced in the United States. It was a good day. We've been asking the court to restrict these kinds of sentences for several years, and I'm delighted that the court ruled in our favor and invalidated over 2,000 sentences where children have been sentenced to die in prison.
I would guess you'd think this is not just a good day for the law, but a good day for science.
I do. I think part of what has helped us make these arguments effectively is persuading the court that children are different than adults. That's pretty obvious to a lot of people. But over the last 20 years, some rhetoric has emerged that some children, and it's worth noting that about 70% of these kids are black or brown, or kids of color, some kids are beyond hope, beyond redemption, and you can recognize it very early on. They were labeled as super predators. They were demonized. They were described as thugs and not really children. And you know, we've had to actually demonstrate why adolescent development means that most kids, not just kids at risk, make mistakes, don't have the judgment, don't have the maturity, don't have the skills to be treated the way we treat adults. And one of our primary arguments was that in every area of the law, we protect child status. We don't let kids drink. We don't let them smoke, no matter how smart they are. We don't let them vote. We don't let them do a lot of things, and we protect them, except in the criminal justice system, where we increasingly have sentenced them just as if they were adults, even if they're as young as 13 or 14 years of age.
The idea that kids are different predates modern neurology. It goes back to ancient times. It seems that this mandatory sentencing of mostly minority kids to life in prison is a modern racist adaptation.
Well, there's no question that it is very recent. 50 years ago, the idea that we would be condemning hundreds of kids, some as young as 13 years of age, to die in prison, to life imprisonment without parole, I think would have struck most people, it's pretty misguided. The United States is the only country in the world that condemns children in this way. And it has been a development that has coincided with the emergence of mass incarceration and the politics of fear and anger, which I think have disproportionately victimized people of color, marginalized communities of color, and created a great deal of despair and poor minority communities that have caused many of us to really resist this.
Now, this ruling doesn't let anybody out of jail immediately.
That's right. What the court said is that a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment without parole, that is a sentence where the judge had no discretion to consider the age of the child, is unconstitutional. That doesn't mean that courts can't reinstate some of these sentences. But the court went on to note that it believes that given what we know about adolescent development, what we know about child status, it expects these kinds of sentences to be, quote, uncommon moving forward. And I think that's an important observation. We really are hoping that most of these kids will not be resent to life without parole. Some have been in prison for decades, and many of them could be released because they've demonstrated the kind of maturity, the kind of reform, the kind of recovery that typically allows adult offenders to be released. And we're really now, in that regard, hoping that there will be some people who are deserving that will have a second chance.
Yes, some people are now approaching middle age in prison for crimes that were committed when they were young teenagers.
That's absolutely right. I mean, one of the really heartbreaking aspects of this issue is the way in which these single mistakes in some instances have caused, you know, a lifetime of harm, and that's obviously to the victims of any crimes, but also to these young folks. We got the court to ban life without parole sentences for kids convicted of non-homicide in 2010, and one of the first people we represented after that decision came down was a man who had been sentenced to life in prison without parole in Louisiana in the early 1960s. He had been in prison for nearly 50 years, and it was wonderful to see him released, but quite tragic to see how he had been treated.
And do you think international embarrassment plays any role in U.S. policy or U.S. judicial policy these days? Can the United States be embarrassed?
Well, we tend to be pretty myopic. I do think one of the challenges we have in this country is that we're actually pretty arrogant about our own human rights issues. I think increasingly we have to be more attentive to international norms and values. I think policies like this one have undermined our credibility, have undermined our reputation when it comes to calling for human rights protections across the globe. There is a covenant on the rights of the child, an international document that protects children from prostitution and slavery and abusive work conditions and all kinds of horrific things. And every country in the world has signed it except two, Somalia and the United States. And I think that really does discredit and compromise the U.S. on issues of human rights globally. And we're going to have to pay more attention to these issues at home if we're going to be a leader abroad.
And, of course, Somalia hasn't even had a government since the early 90s. That leaves the United States by itself.
That's exactly right. It's not a lack of resistance to the protocols or the treaty itself that has kept Somalia from signing. But in the U.S., because this document prohibits the death penalty and excessive punishment of children, the U.S. has refused to sign and says something, I think, really disturbing about the way we think about child status and the needs of kids in this country, that we have been unwilling to sign that document.
That was Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative.
Earlier last month, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down key parts of Arizona's anti-immigrant law. Shanta Driver, the national chairperson of BAM, By Any Means Necessary, says the court's ruling is a victory, but that doesn't mean it's a new day for immigrant rights.
I think the decision was a victory in that it made clear that even with this extremely conservative Supreme Court, the excesses that the far right wing wanted in terms of immigration reform just could not stand. And the idea of making virtually every American citizen a deputized member of the ICE was not going to stand, as well as just depriving people of their basic human rights to be able to come to this country and seek employment. And I think in those ways it was a victory, but I think it would be wrong to assume from the immigration decision and the health care decision that Justice Roberts has had a rebirth as some type of a moderate. I just think that those things are not true, and that if we're not able to build a movement over the next period of time, we're not going to see the kind of extensive immigration reform that is really needed to make it possible for people to live in the United States safely and continue to contribute, as they have been doing for some time now, to the economy and growth of the nation.
Well, this ruling doesn't mean that racial profiling isn't still in full effect in Arizona, as elsewhere.
I think that's true. I think the racial profiling part is also a part of the Federal Secure Communities Act, which many, many, many cities and communities have been refusing to implement because it allows for the same thing and, in fact, encourages the same thing as the Arizona law of local police stopping people and asking for identification. So I think that trend is certainly still there. And at the same time, I think that even those kinds of provisions, even if the court didn't strike them down, in practice, it's going to be very, very difficult for other states to adopt such laws, not because there isn't a great deal of anti-immigrant sentiment in many other parts of the country, but because it's proved to be so disastrous to the economy of Arizona, where there now is a very profound labor shortage because those draconian laws have meant that many, many, many people have left Arizona, not to return to Mexico, but to go to other states where they couldn't work and live in much greater safety.
And BAM's position is that what we need is a broad and deep social movement to transform this situation.
I think that's right. I mean, I think what we've seen in the way of reform from the Obama administration in terms of setting policies, administrative policies that could move in the right direction around immigration reform have only come about because of concern around winning the Latino vote. And should President Obama get reelected, and I think he will, it's still going to take a movement to have any extension of those policies. There won't be another election in which the administration feels that it's necessary to make concessions or try to actually act on the agenda of the people that elected Obama 4 years ago and will probably reelect President Obama, but with a great deal more trepidation this time around.
He got two-thirds of the Hispanic vote last time and still became the champion deporter of all time.
That's exactly right. I mean, especially of young people. And he's been prepared to be the person to split up families, to carry out measures that have been very extreme in terms of deportation. And I just think that if there isn't a new civil rights movement fighting around the question of immigrant rights, opposing the new Jim Crow, opposing the permanent second-class status of people without papers, there is going to be no progress. This is a moment in history where capital can cross borders without any kind of infringements or limitations, in which factories and jobs can cross borders with no limitations placed on them. The only people who are suffering from limitations and from being cast as being illegal are the people who are following those jobs and following those opportunities. There's something that is just so profoundly unfair about that. And even for those people who call themselves free marketeers, they ought to be for giving labor the same right of free access and free travel that they have been given capital.
In terms of racial profiling in general, I remember before 9/11 when black folks thought that they had won great victories in the fight against racial profiling.
One of the things that I think we can learn from the immigration fight is that if it affects one, it affects all. I think the number of incidents of racial profiling of black people has gone up in the aftermath of these laws because it's just kind of meant free rights for any racist cop or sheriff to be able to implement whatever policy they want. There was a big scandal in the state of Alabama that passed a law very similar to the Arizona law because state troopers there pulled over executives that were Honda executives and executives from another, I think, German foreign car company and put them in jail for not having papers on them. And they were Asian and black. And, you know, needless to say, when they got out of jail, they made the decision that Alabama was not a place that they wanted to be building new factories in. And I think that kind of a system where you would pull over somebody who, two people in a very, very fancy car, in very expensive suits who are black and Asian is just tantamount to what occurs when these laws are in place.
Shanta Driver of BAM, By Any Means Necessary, speaking from Detroit.
Back in 1998, three white men dragged James Byrd Jr. to his death, chained to their pickup truck in Jasper, Texas. The hate crime put Jasper on the map in the most horrific way possible. Then last year, blacks on the Jasper City Council pushed through the hiring of the town's first black police chief, Rodney Pearson, a decorated former state trooper. But whites in Jasper then recalled two of the black city councilmen and fired the black police chief. His attorney, Dave Burson, is taking the case to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
A group called the Concerned Citizens Group, which was an all-white group, signed petitions to recall these two black councilmen. Under the antiquated law or the charter of the city of Jasper, they were able to do this.
Well, it seems that there are elements in the white community that don't really care about Jasper's reputation nationally, and that might include the mayor.
Oh, it definitely includes the mayor, and you're right. They don't care. They believe that they can do or say whatever they want to do and say without repercussions or anybody taking issue with them. The mayor owns the largest radio station in Jasper, and he has used that, in my opinion, as a weapon to push his agenda about getting the councilman, the black councilman, as well as the police chief.
Your client was also a decorated highway patrolman, but his opponents in Jasper say he wasn't qualified to be police chief.
Well, that's what they said. They first started out, some of them said that he was a racist and hated white people before some of them knew that his wife was white and he had biracial children. But certainly they said that he's not qualified. Well, the Texas Department of Public Safety is one of the best law enforcement organizations, I believe, in the country, and he served 21 years there. And then for them to say that he wasn't qualified because of that experience is absolutely nonsense. Now, after he became the interim chief, they concocted this matrix that had never been used to rate the applicants for the police chief's the permanent position. It had never been used in hiring all the other white police chiefs, but was suddenly appeared and was going to be used to rate these now that Jasper had a black interim police chief. Again, it's reminiscent of the time in the South where they used to give literacy tests and to do everything that they could to prevent blacks from voting. But former Chief Pearson is more than qualified to do that job. Was then, is now, and it's just purely race.
That was attorney David Burson in Jasper, Texas.
Lynn Stewart, the New York-based human rights attorney, sentenced to 10 years in prison on charges related to her defense of a terrorism defendant, has lost an appeal in federal court. She's confined at a medical prison near Fort Worth, Texas. We spoke with Lynn Stewart's husband and fellow activist, Ralph Pointer.
When I read the papers, and I read them again, one of the things that struck me was they're referring to Lynn as having disrespect for the law. My reaction to that is anybody who studied the history of American law knows it's based in genocide, slavery, and the double standard. And so the only things that we can look to in America that are positive are those people who disobeyed the law and those people who fought to right the wrongs, who followed justice rather than law. I like that better. And I am proud of her. I am not saddened. The things they said about her give me great pride. We don't have to look far to see where she was afoul of the law when she was an adult, you know, supporting immigrant rights, immigrant children, supporting the black movement. And all of these things opposed the law. So they and those of us who see justice are coming at opposite ends. So I applaud Lynn. She has just had her operation that she should have had 36 months ago, and she was scheduled to have her operation when the Second Circuit said she must go to jail immediately because she's traveling around the country to law schools and universities, corrupting our youth. So she has just had her operation. She went to a hospital. She said she had good treatment at the hospital, but they said it was time to go back, not according to medical necessity, but to prison necessity. She was concerned about going back to a prison that is not hospital clean. But Antoinette Martinez, an inmate from the Bronx, made sure that the section she went back to in the prison was as clean as a hospital. And this really gives me, Lynn says when she looked and saw it, she came to tears, that the inmates know who she is and they're protecting her. They're clean. So here we are. You know, Lynn is fighting for the rights of the people in there, and some of the people inside understand who she is, and they're fighting for her rights the best way they can.
Ralph Pointer, husband of imprisoned human rights lawyer Lynn Stewart.
In 2005, the state of Louisiana took advantage of the destruction caused by Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans to fire virtually all the employees of the public schools. They were replaced mainly by charter schools. The public school employees fought back with a class action suit and won a victory. We spoke with their lawyer, Willie Zanders.
The charter school system in New Orleans that has been touted as the best thing since apple pie and ice cream was created while 7,500 New Orleans public schools employees were displaced after Hurricane Katrina. And the original 13 schools that opened as charter schools were in fact scheduled to be open as traditional public schools, wherein the pre-Katrina employees would return to those schools as the floodwaters receded, and they thought upon leaving the city that they would return to their jobs, but they were not. And as of November 30th, 2005, the state legislature passed a law to take over 107 New Orleans public schools, and the takeover was based on a change in the school performance score, which was originally 60 at the time of Katrina, and it was changed retroactively to 87.5. a couple months later while the employees were displaced all over the country. So it was the beginning of the wrongful takeover.
So we had manufactured evidence of failure after the opportunity, or so the powers that be saw it, of Katrina.
Yes, and it is interesting that it was manufactured evidence of failure because the state superintendent of education sent a letter to the U.S. Office of Education dated September 14th asking for $2.4 billion in federal funds to help restart schools in the areas affected by Katrina. So the funds were requested as of September 14th, and eventually the federal government sent approximately $600 million to reopen the schools. And as opposed to opening the pre-Katrina schools, the state chose not to open schools. There was a lawsuit filed. I didn't file it, but some friends of mine filed a lawsuit to force them to open schools because they wanted to wait a year so that they can get the charter school movement started. Given the disaster caused by Katrina, it was un-American at that point to request federal money and not use it to rehire the school employees.
It sounds very much like what people have called disaster capitalism.
I think that would apply in New Orleans. Matter of fact, you talked about disaster capitalism. There was one consultant hired by the state who made a statement in an article we found that we presented to the court during the trial last year, where he said that New Orleans was like a rotten English borough, ripe for the political pickings. So many people saw this as an opportunity to privatize public education. And in fact, they did. And so that's the nature of the charter school movement in New Orleans: disaster capitalism and privatizing public education.
And you're saying that they even delayed the opening of schools in order to get all their charter ducks in a row.
To get them in a row, to get the charter ducks in a row. Yes, in fact, the Martin Luther King High School, there were volunteers trying to open the school, and they didn't want them to go in to help clean up. And then a lawsuit was filed against the state at the point that there were over 300 students on a waiting list. And that's why I think this story needs to be told, that as opposed to helping the pre-Katrina employees get their lives back together again, the state and the local school board conspired to start a new with charter school movement, which now has about 80% of all schools in New Orleans are charter. And as far as I'm concerned, these are publicly funded private schools. That's what we're dealing with in New Orleans.
And it seems that the agenda was not just the charterization or privatization of the schools, but part and parcel with emptying New Orleans of some types of people.
Our case did not focus on the nature of the bigger picture of whether or not certain pre-Katrina residents, namely African Americans, would be allowed to return. But we do know that there were steps taken to, quote-unquote, shrink the footprint so that in the Ninth Ward area of the city that was inhabited for the most part by African Americans, until this day has not been fully rehabilitated, and the individuals are still dispersed in many parts of the country. We don't single out the issue as that of race per se, but we do say that politics, inhumanity to some extent, which is really bad in and of itself, but our political fight centered on the education issues without opening up the bigger question of to what extent were African Americans disenfranchised. That's an ongoing fight. It is not our fight, but it is a fact that many middle-income African Americans were displaced in the public school system, but we would not fight the battle on race as much as power and politics, and that the public school employees suffered at the hands of local and state action.
Nevertheless, proportionately speaking, the New Orleans teaching force is a lot wider than it was pre-Katrina, isn't it?
The facts will show that the New Orleans teaching faculty has, I would say, a higher percentage of Teach for America teachers who are not certified. Yes, thousands of African Americans were displaced and they're no longer employees with Orleans. But again, when you're winning in court on other state issues, one does not have to focus on whether or not they were black or white, but all had rights under state law. And yes, African Americans have suffered disproportionately, but our legal battle is based on states' rights, dealing with certification as a teacher and seniority, and we've been very successful in pursuing their rights based on those state claims as opposed to issues of race.
And they also had gains made as unionized teachers that were, of course, lost.
Yes, and yes, now I am free to comment on that. Part of the goal of the charter school movement, as orchestrated by the state, was to eliminate collective bargaining. And they have done that, and we think to the detriment of public education, so that charter schools do not have to allow teachers to bargain collectively, and in many instances, their rights are being violated. About 460 teachers were temporarily removed from the state's teachers' retirement system last year in some of the charter schools, and we fought that as a separate issue, and they were able to rejoin the state's retirement system. But yes, many of those former employees have had their rights denied, disrespected. That is a problem with the charter school movement.
Now, of course, you're the lawyer for a whole class of plaintiffs, even though only a small number immediately gained from the decision, correct?
In the class action, I am the lead attorney working with a group of seven court-appointed attorneys. And in this class action ruling that just came out last week, seven class representatives or named plaintiffs were awarded damage awards ranging from $48,000 to $480,000. Now, that's not a question of damages, so only seven were awarded damages at that point. However, the entire class benefited from the ruling that the local school board was liable for wrongful termination and state officials were liable for wrongful termination. So as to liability, the entire class won. As to damages, the first seven, and then in subsequent proceedings, other plaintiffs will be able to come forward to prove their damages, but they will not have to reprove liability. Liability has been proven for all 7,000 plaintiffs.
Now, are the circumstances of New Orleans unique, or does this precedent have impact on other charterizing school districts?
It's my thinking that state officials will be forced to look at state-mandated rights for public school employees prior to opening up charter schools. And even after a charter school has been established, the rights in the prior school district should prevail, and those public school employees should not lose the rights acquired by state law. So we hope that charter school officials and public school officials around the country will look at the fact that once the state has granted certain due process rights, then even charter school officials who take over the school should be required to honor those rights. Now, some state laws will be different, but at least the argument and the question will be raised as to whether or not those rights are going to exist and if they're going to be protected. So at least the questions will have to be asked.
So what you've done is helped expose a massive financial and political and moral injustice, and yet the pro-charter people, and that includes the President of the United States, hold up the new New Orleans system as the poster child of school reform, as they call
it. Well, that's a heavy-duty question because you mentioned the President of the United States, and out of respect for his office, I'm saying we would be willing to share with the President of the United States and his Secretary of Education some of the facts that we know, things we learned, problems with the charter school movement, how in many instances the rights of public school employees are trampled, that in Louisiana, I can quote these numbers, for the charter schools in Louisiana, 1 year ago, there were 29 Ds, these are letter grades assigned to some of those schools, 27 Fs, letter grades assigned to those schools. I think there were less than 5 letter grades of B. So we would invite the president and his Secretary of Education and staff to visit us in New Orleans, and let's have a roundtable discussion about the pros and cons of charter school and about protecting the rights of public school employees. And while they're here, whoever is here representing the president, we want to talk about the $600 million in federal funds that were sent to put these employees back to work after Katrina, and they never received the money.
Willie Zanders, attorney for 7,500 fired public school employees in New Orleans.
On June 27th of last year, the People's Organization for Progress, POP, a grassroots organization based in Newark, New Jersey, began a marathon of daily demonstrations for jobs, justice, education, and peace. Last week, they passed the one-year mark and will soon match the longevity of the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. POP Chairman Larry Hamm.
We started this effort, the daily protests for jobs, peace, equality, and justice. We started on June 27, 2011. We started out on a 30-day trial run, and at the end of the first 30 days, we decided we would go 381 days, which was the length of the Montgomery bus boycott. The 381st day will be July 11th, and we're calling for a major march for jobs, peace, equality, and justice on that day. There was a big question when we first started out if we would be able to go the whole 381 days. There was a big question whether we were going to be able to do it every day consecutively without a break, and we have done that. And we started out basically on our own, People's Organization for Progress, and in the process, we've obtained the endorsements and built a coalition around this project that includes 179 other organizations. We started out basically doing these daily protests on our own, and gradually we have been joined on each day by a different one of our co-sponsors or endorsers, I guess we would call them. And we've, over the course of this year, been joined by union groups, union locals, labor organizations, churches, student organizations, grassroots community groups, fraternities and sororities, just all kind of a wide range of organizations reflecting the broad political spectrum, but united with us on this question of jobs have joined us. So basic goals have been accomplished. However, there's still some challenges. When groups come out and join us for the protests, we have good numbers. When groups don't come out and join us, the numbers are small. So there's always that challenge of increasing the actual level of participation. You know, when we first went out there, people looked at us like we were crazy. But now people blow their horns and throw their fists out in the air and greet us. And people even stop. We've had people stop and leave crates of cold water for us as the warm weather came upon us. And we've had people bring us hot coffee and hot chocolate when we were out there on the cold day. These are people that we didn't even know. We certainly draw an attention to the issue of unemployment in our community. We certainly raised some consciousness around that issue, and we've certainly built a base of support among the people who come through the daily protests.
We've talked to lots of people who've endorsed your project over the past year, and many of them have said that they've enjoyed a political education. But what kind of education have you gotten?
Well, I've gotten some hardcore organizing lessons. That's the kind of education I've got. We've done general political education around the nature of the economic crisis and the roots of the unemployment catastrophe and so on and so forth. But in terms of organizing lessons, what I've learned is probably something a lot of people know intrinsically, but what I've actually seen in practice is that we have a lot of work to do on our side of the fence. When I say our side of the fence, I'm certainly talking about progressive grassroots organizations. We have to strengthen ourselves. You know, we've been supported and endorsed by unions that have memberships of 3,000, but I've yet to see one of those union locals mobilize a fraction of that membership. Some of the locals have joined us on any given day, brought out 50, 60 people, and that's a lot of folks, you know, to join us for the daily protests. But I certainly had some eye-opening lessons in terms of our movement is very weak. It's painful. And when I say our, I'm talking about the Organization for Progress as well. For instance, we have 179 organizations in this coalition. If each group only brought out 10 people, say when we call for an all-out mobilization like we're doing on July 11th, that would be almost 2,000 people. But the closest we've come in terms of our largest march has been maybe 600-700 people, the largest march that we've had. If we could bring, let's just say, 100 or 200 people to the daily protests on a daily basis, it would literally change the political environment in the city of Newark because no one else does that. And, you know, if each group would just bring, you know, a certain number on any given day, and the different groups could do that consistently, that would be a show of strength. But I've yet to see that kind of mobilization. And, you know, the other thing is you would think that we would get really strong support for something like this from labor. Now, we have gotten support from a number of union locals. We've even gotten the endorsement of a couple of the labor councils, like the Essex County Labor Council and the Hudson Labor Council. But we haven't been embraced in a way by the upper echelons of labor leadership that I thought we might, since we were raising the issue of jobs in the most general way, you know, for working people in general, not to mention for groups that have catastrophic rates of unemployment like African Americans. It's just a lot of work to be done. And that real tedious, unglamorous, painstaking work of building a constituency that can be mobilized consistently on any issue that affects our people, that's the work that really remains to be done. And I'm sure some people are doing it. I'm not saying it's not being done, but I haven't seen the result in the street. And I think in terms of the future, you know, what we're looking for, because this economic crisis is going to deepen. It's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And I think people are massaging the numbers and doing the best they can to put their fingers in the holes in the dike, you know, until after this presidential election, because they don't want the worst possible news to come out before the presidential election. But I think this thing is really going to get bad. And I think for the days and months ahead, the point of challenge is really going to be in the streets. You know, how many people can we bring into the streets and keep in the streets on a protracted basis, not for one day, not for 2 days, but for weeks if necessary, or months if necessary, until we can really awaken, get a general awakening amongst working people, poor people, and the middle class.
Well, certainly, for what it's worth, you have built up moral authority in this year of struggle. As the crisis deepens, I'm sure it'll serve you.
you're right. We have built up moral authority, and I think symbolic of the kind of moral authority we have obtained as a result of this project and being out there for an entire year is that I was recently asked to be the grand marshal for the Labor Day parade that will occur starting at the Bato House Labor Museum in Passaic. Now, I don't know if I should say this or not, but I'll say it anyway. I'm not a member of a union. I've never been a member of a union, not because I didn't want to, only because I never was in a job that was unionized, per se. But I think because of the work that Pop has done around this project, which certainly has raised labor issues, many of the core demands that we have for the daily protest pertain to labor, that we have been recognized as fighting in the interests of working people. And I think that a guy that's the head of an all-volunteer grassroots organization would end up the grand marshal of the Labor Day parade in a state that has literally hundreds of labor locals and labor organizations and councils and stuff. You know, I think that says something. I think it's a direct result of the work we've done. Also, recently, I received the Leadership Award from the A. Philip Randolph Institute from the Essex and Union County branches at their combined annual dinner that was held, I believe it was at the end of May. So, you know, we are being recognized in certain circles of labor for the work that we're doing, and this is certainly an advance for the People's Organization for Progress. It definitely represents an advance in terms of the ties that we are making to working folks.
And it shows that people are making the connection, the interconnectivity of struggle.
Absolutely. You know, I think some people are finally, you know, coming to the realization that they're straight. I mean, we used to say this all the time, but, you know, sometimes it takes a long time for people to really grasp it in practice, and, you know, that their struggle is our struggle and our struggle is their struggle, that, you know, the community is labor after 5 o'clock, you know, and that labor is the community after 8 a.m., you know, the same struggle, you know. I mean, all these struggles are interconnected, and this project, this daily protest, has been a vehicle to help us make those connections in practice. You know, it's one thing to know something in theory, but it's another thing to actually realize it through your practical organizing work.
Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey.
Rwanda's role in destabilizing the Democratic Republic of Congo has been documented over and over again. Yet Rwanda's main ally and patron, the United States, refuses to exert pressure on its client. We spoke with Claude Gatabukwe of the African Great Lakes Network.
The United States' role has been, one, an enabler, because the U.S. is one of the largest donor to the Rwandan government in terms of funds, but also in military training. So between the period of 2000 and 2010, the United States had given over $1 billion to Rwanda, and Rwanda received nearly $200 million in aid annually. And speaking of war criminals, when you give a war criminal more resources, they commit more crime. The other has been that it's been reported that recently, when the Group of Experts report came out, the United States mission to the UN was blocking its release until Rwanda provided their response to the allegation. And the other is that the U.S. has not held accountable Rwanda, who is a U.S. ally. Rwanda is a U.S. ally, has not held them accountable for the crimes committed in the Congo. There is a law on the books that President Obama put in place when he was a senator in 2006 that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton co-signed, and basically the law states that the Secretary of State has the power to withhold aid to any countries deemed to destabilize the Congo. And to this day, the United States has not enforced that law, in spite of all of the reports that have come out, in spite of all of the evidence that's come out showing that Rwanda's been destabilizing Congo.
Here we have Rwanda, demonstrably part of the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world since World War II, the genocide in the Congo. And yet the United States won't stop one of its allies from what it's doing in Congo.
It's a big paradox. You look at the actions in Libya and various other places, and you just wonder, what will it take for the United States to hold accountable its allies in Rwanda and Uganda for crimes committed in the Congo? And it should. Now is a perfect opportunity for the Obama administration not to make the mistakes made in 1994 by the Clinton administration during the Rwandan genocide. If the U.S. is to avoid making the same mistakes made in 1994 that ended with a million Rwandan butchered to death, Obama must act swiftly and decisively and begin to withhold aid from Rwanda until, especially military training, until it is demonstrated that Rwanda is no longer active in the Congo. This is a prescription that has been tried, tested, and it's worked. In 2008, when General Nkunda of the CNDP, the parent of the current M23 rebellion in the Congo, was ravaging eastern Congo, Sweden and the Netherlands withheld aid from Rwanda. Immediately after that, Rwanda arrested General Laurent Nkunda, who is still in Rwanda today. So if the U.S. is to take a strong stance, and if the Obama administration is to enforce its own directive on prevention of mass atrocities, now is a perfect opportunity to hold accountable one of its allies and begin withholding aid and begin taking action to stop the death toll in the Congo.
Certainly, if some minor players in world affairs, if their actions had that kind of effect on Rwanda, if the United States, its main backer and ally and supplier and diplomatic defender, were to take those actions, there's no doubt Rwanda would change its behavior.
Absolutely. There is no doubt that that would change, because a large chunk of Rwanda's budget is aid. And the biggest donors, again, are the U.S. and the United Kingdom.
A large portion of Rwanda's budget is from the United States, but a large portion of the riches that Rwanda's elite are making come from the eastern Congo.
That's right. Illegal mining in the Congo has contributed majorly to both Rwanda's economy and to individual leaders and government agents and business people in Rwanda. Since 1997, there are countless reports that show a spike in the amount of exported minerals, minerals that are known to come out of the Congo and not known to come in abundance in Rwanda. The supply far, far exceeds Rwanda's capacity to produce minerals. And so, yes, you're right that there is a large portion of Rwanda's budget that comes from donors. There's also a large portion of Rwanda's economy that's built on illegal exploitation of Congolese resources.
That was Claude Gadabuke of the African Great Lakes Network.
An appeals court has let stand Jamaican musical artist Buju Banton's 10-year prison sentence on charges of possession with intent to distribute cocaine. Banton was not in physical possession of drugs when he was arrested in Florida back in 2009, but prosecutors claim he was an investor in a drug scheme. The prosecution relied heavily on a paid informant. Many of Buju Banton's supporters see his predicament as political. Chris Sweeney, editor of The New Times in Miami, has been covering the case.
It's political in the sense that it's a perfect demonstration of the Department of Justice pushing constitutional rights out of the way and really dumping a lot of money into a case that didn't have a lot of teeth. And I think that kind of is among Buju's supporters that started to realize that Buju's case kind of represents a lot of cases in America in terms of the use of confidential informants who make millions of dollars of untaxed income in the United States And I think there's two different camps. There's the Bougie supporters in Jamaica, and then there's the Bougie supporters in America. And, you know, I think there's a lot of similarities between the two. I do think that supporters in the United States are kind of a bit more outraged about this Alex Johnson, the confidential informant. It's tough economic times here in the United States. We have a lot of social problems, yet our government is now spending millions of dollars on a guy who was convicted of a felony cocaine charge years ago, and now he's let loose to run free through the United States, is sucking up tax dollars left and right and not paying taxes on any of it. So that's kind of the political angle that I see in the case.
Chris Sweeney of the New Times newspaper in Miami.
This week is also Buju Banton's birthday. Dr. Carol Cooper is part of Banton's support committee. She's a lecturer at the University of the West Indies in Jamaica. We asked Dr. Cooper if she thinks Banton has been prosecuted for political reasons.
Political, really, for me, has to do with issues of power. Who has control? The control over information, the control to decide who is innocent and who is guilty. And there are many of us in Jamaica who feel that Buju's arrest and incarceration is really an attack on the Jamaican music industry because of the kinds of messages that some of the artists have been sending out about sexual politics. And, you know, that's a feeling on the ground. Sometimes it's very difficult to be rational in these circumstances. So, you know, people like me who just say, I know Buju is innocent. I don't want to hear anything to the contrary. So I know that that is a kind of emotional, irrational response. But it comes from a deep-seated conviction that Buju Banton is an artist of integrity. And I don't believe that he would be dealing drugs. You know, that's just my conviction. So many of us in Jamaica believe that it's a setup. And so we want to see his name cleared because we believe that he has a lot of work to do as a very powerful reggae artist. And he needs to be free to be able to do that work.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Mike Pogo.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.